Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the continuation of the May meeting of the California Fish and Game Commission. Let me make a few introductions. I am, which I forgot to say yesterday, I'm Richard Rogers of Carpinteria, California, and I am the president of the commission. Immediately to my right is Jim Kellogg from Concord, member of the commission. The lady to my left is Cindy Gustafson.
Good morning.
Of Tahoe City Commissioner. Judd Hanna is the next person of Mill Creek Commissioner. We have John Carlson immediately to my left, who is Executive Director. John Fisher is Assistant Executive Director, and he is down the table. Wave your hand, John. Adriana Shea, Sherry Cole, and Sean Cubbage, analysts for the commission. Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General, and he is right on the other side of Mr. Kellogg. Then we have the Director of the Department, Ryan Broderick. We have Sonke Mastrup, Deputy Director of the Department, sitting on the other side of the next person, who is Greg Herner, who is Deputy Director as well. Pardon? Yeah. And then we have also Deputy Director, Chief of Enforcement, Nancy Foley, in the back of the back, along with Warden Foley. Warden Simmons. Excuse me. So I think that's it for introductions this morning, and we have a sort of a special announcement, if I may. I ask Ryan Broderick, Director of the Department, to go to the podium.
Mr. President and members of the Commission, it's my pleasure to announce that the Governor this morning will put out publicly that G. Michael Sutton of Monterey has been appointed as one of your comrades in commission. Mr. Sutton is present. He has been sworn in, and the swearing in has been notarized, so we now have a full commission. Mr. Sutton served as Vice President, Founding Director of the Center for the Future of the Oceans at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Served as a program officer for the Conservation and Science Program of the David and Lucille Packard Foundation, Vice President of U.S. Land and Wildlife Programs for the World Wildlife Fund, Special Agent for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park Service. Interesting, diverse background, committed to the role and the mission of the commission, full support of the governor, and pleased to announce that that position has been filled. Mr. Sutton, if you'd join the dais. If you'd like to say a few words from here or there.
Welcome, Mr. Sutton. It seems like we're welcoming an old friend since we know you so very well. If you'd like to say a few remarks.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. President and Ryan, for that very kind welcome. I know there are millions watching on the webcast, so I'll be brief. It's a great honor for me to join the commission and join such a distinguished group of public servants, both the staff and the my fellow commissioners. I have the greatest respect for these colleagues and their role as stewards of California's wildlife and its habitats, both terrestrial and marine. I'd like to briefly introduce myself to the public so that you all know who you're dealing with here, and say a little bit about the background that I bring to the commission. As far as I'm concerned, I've had a 30-year career in wildlife conservation, but as far as I'm concerned, I don't sit here in a conservation seat or an environmentalist seat on the commission any more than others may sit in a commercial fishing seat or a recreational fishing seat or a hunting seat. We're all here for the same reason, as stewards of the precious wildlife resources of California, and I pledge to be as, I hope to be as good and as effective as that at that as my colleagues. I have a bachelor's degree in wildlife biology, did graduate work in marine biology in Australia, and I have a law degree in natural resources law as well. I spent 6 years as a national park ranger, where I, among other things, had the pleasure of working with Warden Foley, Chief Foley, at Death Valley National Monument, now National Park, many years ago now. I then went on to serve as a federal game warden, otherwise known as a special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and worked for many years with state game wardens, including California, and have utmost respect for them and their jobs. I also have some understanding of what they go through in terms of low pay and difficult working conditions. After that, I spent 10 years at World Wildlife Fund, both in Washington, D.C., and overseas. I started the Marine Conservation Program at WWF U.S. and WWF International. WWF is the largest conservation organization in the world with offices in more than 55 countries. After that, I made the transition from grant seeker to grant maker at the Packard Foundation. Packard Foundation is based in Silicon Valley and is the largest private funder of wildlife conservation in the United States. And then in the last 3 years, I moved to the Monterey Bay Aquarium to start a new program called the Center for the Future of the Oceans, where our mission is to inspire action for conservation of the oceans. Privately, I'm an aviator, as is at least one of my fellow commissioners, and a hunter and a fisherman. I think the last two are particularly important. I've been a hunter for a long time, a wing shooter now, and a fly fisherman, an avid one. I think that gives me a background to deal with many of the issues that may come before the commission. I may not always agree with the perspectives of the various stakeholders, but you can rest assured that I'll always listen. And I'm looking forward to working with all of you to safeguard our wildlife for future generations of Californians. So thank you again for the very kind welcome.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for your remarks. And the commission, rest assured, the commission can hardly wait for you to share more details about your time spent with Chief Foley. That should be very interesting, actually, in her early days of her career. John?
Thank you. A couple of housekeeping things I'd like to remind the audience. Please be aware and recall that we are live streaming on the Internet at this point, and so everything you say and do will be recorded, can be used again. Well, no, I'm just... And for everyone who's watching and folks in the audience, keep in mind that if you go to our website at a later date, every one of our meetings for the last couple of years has been archived, and you can click on certain buttons and get to those meetings and watch them again, you know... very entertaining.
If you make a particularly enthusiastic and well-spoken performance, you can just watch it and watch it and watch it. Just terrific fun.
But we really appreciate being on live Internet, and we really appreciate our audience. I also want to remind everyone in the audience who would like to put in a speaker card on any of the agenda items, we have a 10-minute limit for the day amongst the items, so keep that in mind as you put in your cards. And if you do have a card, bring it over to staff at the table at my far right. If you have documents that you want to hand to the commissioners, drop those off with staff to the far right also, and they will pass them out and log them in. With that, we are going to move the agenda around a little bit as per the commission president. We are going to start with item 16 this morning, which is status update on draft environmental document, receipt of special report, and receipt of public testimony on proposals to amend sections 353 and 475 of Title 14, California Code of Regulations. This is related to methods authorized for taking big game and methods of take for non-game birds and non-game mammals. And we have two presentations we're going to start with this morning before we then hear some info from the department and have discussion. The Peregrine Fund is going to speak, and they have 15 minutes. And then a second group will be speaking after that.
We're all live here, huh? Could have done without the knowledge of the Internet. But thank you for the opportunity, nonetheless, to come and speak.
Actually, since you've spoken to us before, you could actually go into the archive and see how you looked before as well.
I don't think I'll watch it either time.
I think you're wearing the same shirt, but that's all right.
No, same make, but different color. So it'll be up here, and I use this. All right. And will I ruin things if I stand to the side here so I can see it?
Not at all.
All right. Well, thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, you need to give your name as well.
Oh, right. Right. My name is Chris Parrish. I'm with the Peregrine Fund. I direct the Condor Reintroduction Program in Arizona. I've been with the program since 1997, first with Arizona Game and Fish Department, and transferred over in the year of 2000 as project director for the Peregrine Fund.
Oops.
Did I do that? I was just trying to show you how bad I'm shaking here.
The trick is to rest the palm of your hand on the the podium.
I'm learning that.
That's the trick.
Whoa, it's yellow. Well, I have probably more slides than I should have, but I'm going to burn through them to try and give you as much of a representation as possible of the information we've collected in Arizona and have time for questions, it sounds like.
We'll start your time when we can tee up your presentation.
All right. I do remember the lights. That's intimidating.
How are we doing, Steve? We take back everything we said positive yesterday, Steve.
Ready to go? Okay. Should start the Peregrine Fund. We're a private nonprofit organization out of Boise, Idaho, and I'll go through some more history of our involvement with the Condor program. And as you can see, our folks up there in Boise still are confused about the size of falcons and condors, but we'll leave that for something else to talk about. Just a little history. As you may or may not know, the last condor in the wild was captured in 1987 and brought into a population of just 27 birds. The all-time low occurred in 1982, and that was 22 individual condors. The population declining from an original amount, it's argued whether it was 200 or 400 or 600 birds, but nonetheless, the population declined so rapidly that measures were taken to put these birds into captivity and to begin a captive breeding program. It's represented here in the offspring produced in captivity, and then later on in 1992, beginning here in California, and 1996, adding to it in Arizona, a wild population through reintroductions. In the beginning, I'd like to remind everybody we had more questions than just this one that we're dealing with today. Would these birds reproduce in captivity? Would they reproduce in the wild? Is there enough available forage? With number of birds being shot, those that were collected, predation, natural type mortality factors, habitat loss, and ultimately a naturally slow reproductive rate, not allowing these birds to adapt to the ever-changing at an exponential rate environment. Why their numbers declined. In California from 1982 to 1985, 15 condors disappeared or died from a population of just 24 birds, leaving 9 in the wild. Only 4 of those birds were recovered for necropsy, 3 of which were diagnosed as having died of lead poisoning. 2 were confirmed by positive identification of fragments in their digestive systems. In 1993, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service approached us, the Peregrine Fund, to join the captive breeding program. We would join a project well underway that involved the San Diego Wild Animal Park, the Los Angeles Zoo, and more recently, the Oregon Zoo in captive reproduction. Our release site, located in the southern half of Utah and the northern half of Arizona, is a non-essential experimental designated area, and that's a portion of verbiage from the Article 10J of the Endangered Species Act, which we won't go into the details there. Specifically, with the state line here and this being Lake Powell and the Colorado River, the Grand Canyon, and right here in the Kaibab Plateau, we're situated adjacent to that plateau, which holds an awful lot of deer as potential carrion, as well as cattle that are grazed, bighorn sheep, elk, and some smaller critters that these birds feed on. So our release site is situated right here on the side of the Paria Plateau. And this is Highway 89A to the south here. Is there something I'm doing to cause that? Okay.
No, it's not. It's we have some culprits around us who are still using their cell phones.
I see. Okay. So the area of detail for the state of Arizona here, and I better get to moving here. Yeah, pretty pictures. You got to have one of a condor out in the wild. So the questions we had in an attempt to develop a self-sustaining population is, where will they range? Will they forage on their own, find enough food, breed in the wild? Same question. But what we're focusing on today is the mortality factors. We had breeding in the wild with the first successful wild hatch in 2003 down in the Grand Canyon. And pretty interesting that the caves that were chosen down there, one of which had ancestral condor bones in them, so they were once used by condors in the past, and they were about 50 miles from the release site, so the condors chose them on their own and started reproducing. Two wild-fledged in 2004, two more in 2005, but in 2006 we had the big goose egg, no wild hatches. Two new pairs, probably expected that they wouldn't successfully reproduce, but the third pair, one who had produced before, actually were thwarted by lead poisoning. We've released 96 birds, had 38 fatalities, three birds returned to captivity, five wild hatches, resulting in nearly 60 birds in the wild as of today. Causes of mortality, lead poisoning being chief among them. They have 12 confirmed cases. These are confirmed by necropsy. These are not cases where there's still a question as to what their cause of death was. These are confirmed. Two others were unconfirmed but suggestive of lead poisoning due to other poisoning events around the same time and the birds spending time together. However, the carcasses weren't recovered in time to have a proper necropsy, and therefore they're just unconfirmed, suggestive of PB exposure. The second leading cause of death for our 10-year project in Arizona is predation, one that we honestly expected to see. But please note that the last predation, knock on wood, occurred in 2003, and that's probably indicative of having a wild population now, so that young birds that we're introducing into this population have the benefit of older generations out there successfully foraging and learning from them. I'd like to also call your attention to the six missing and presumed dead and two unknown here. And we'll talk about that in a moment. Looking at the first 5 years versus the second 5 years, both of these five-year reports are available on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services page. We just completed the second five-year review, but I'd like to show the causes of mortality in the first and second 5 years. And you can see, again, chief among them is lead. And in the second 5 years, it's even higher. 45% of our fatalities have been caused by lead. In the first few years, prior to 1999, we hadn't even done any testing because the birds weren't going too far away from the release site. They were primarily feeding on carcasses that we provide for them and have provided consistently since the inception of the program. It has not been in an effort to keep them off of lead laced food. It's just been to keep the birds coming to the release site so that we can monitor them. In 1999, we saw a little bit of exposure. We had one bird showing exposure. In the summer of 2000, repeat, the summer of 2000, we saw a huge level of exposure. And it seemed to be an anomalous, unusual event that involved shotgun pellets that these birds had ingested. And the treatment required, represented here in yellow, keep in mind this is number of birds tested, those who showed at levels indicating exposure, and those who were treated. In 2001, that fell off. We saw some exposure, but it looked as though this anomalous event wasn't going to be very much to worry about. We identified the presence of lead shot. I'm a hunter myself. These look like number 7.5 and number 4 lead shot. So what they'd gotten into, we don't know, but we knew that it was lead shot, and we had 13 birds show levels of exposure during this event. Two died confirmed of this, and another one died later on. Being scavengers, we had to ask ourselves, what are their food sources and where are they foraging, and when do these exposures peak? So we began an even tighter method of tracking these birds through satellite telemetry and basic radio telemetry to know where they are, and we have about a 87 to 95% contact rate throughout the years with these birds, so I can tell you where they are, and if they're gone for 3 or 4 days, we're out there in aircraft trying to find them, because we don't want to lose this information if a bird dies of how it died, because this program, this experiment in Arizona, in a large part, may well represent what happened to the condors in their original recent historic habitat here in California. Looking at numbers of samples of blood draws, 44 in January and February. This is a period from 2001 to 2005. Most of these data are available on our website, and the book will be, there's a book of the AOU symposia that will be published. We just sent in our final drafts and our final edits last week. They will be available through the AOU. Oops. If we look at the amounts of exposure observed, the yellow here is relatively low compared to the red. The red indicates a severe exposure, one that means that the bird got into lead probably within a week or so of or had a higher exposure longer ago. But the red is what I want you to pay attention to. We're looking at two-month periods, and the highest level of occurrence of lead shows here in November and December through these 4 years and the 2 years since. Looking at the number of birds showing exposure and those requiring treatment, you see something happen here in 2002 when you look at all the years, but I'm not going to show you that yet. And you see that the level of exposure per 100% of birds being trapped is increasing, and the number of those birds needing treatment has increased. Well, what happened is the birds began utilizing the Kaibab Plateau. This is a bit confusing, but if you'll focus on the yellow, this shows the amount of utilization of the Kaibab Plateau in yellow from July 2001 through May 2005. And look that it peaks, not a lot of utilization of the Kaibab in 2001, a lot of utilization in 2002, quite a bit in 2003, and it drops off sharply here. The reason it drops off sharply is by this time we had identified that most of our exposure occurred from during the hunting season. So we trapped all the birds early this year and held them, which is why you see a sharp drop off of utilization of the Kaibab Plateau. It showed in the data. And again, in 2004, 2005, and 2006 looked the same. I just haven't gotten the Excel file to actually be able to produce it. GPS transmitters. How confident are we of where these birds are? We have hourly fixes of these birds, as many as 17 a day, so I can tell you exactly where the birds are. This is a depiction of, here's the state line, here's the release site, south rim of the Grand Canyon, Kaibab Plateau, and these are all of the hits for a particular year. Each different color and different symbol represents a different bird. I'm going to blow through these for time's sake. But I want to show you a monthly representation of where the birds are and what they're doing. Keep in mind that the hunting area is also right here on the Kaibab Plateau, and this is the area of most utilization for condors on the Kaibab. These are the hunting areas. So we start in January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August. See that constriction in August there on the Kaibab Plateau? What's happening there? Increased utilization of the Kaibab by people getting out there looking because they've been lucky enough to be drawn for a deer tag, and there's also an archery season that begins usually in September. Now pay particular attention to the movement from this point, which is about 9,000 feet on the Kaibab Plateau, to the west. October, November, and December. That movement off of the Kaibab Plateau is not because the condors don't like the snow. It's because the deer push out into the lower scrub area here. And any hunter who's been lucky enough to be drawn there in the last 10 years, which doesn't include me, it knows that when the snows come early, it pushes the deer out into the flats, and you can actually find them. Condors are visual scavengers. They utilize these flats and watching other scavengers, including people, to dictate where they go and forage throughout the day. And then January, okay, I'm going to go through this. This is the Zion area of southern Utah, but we don't have time. But here's the same representation for all of those. So let me just blow through those. We're seeing the same results in birds that are utilizing Idaho. Wow, not yet. Birds that are utilizing Utah. And two of the last birds that remained up there in December both died of lead poisoning. Looking back at this again, it's you can see with the exposures increasing in November and December and where the birds are, we thought we had an idea of what was going on. We know that their choice food source is deer. So the next question, especially being hunters, is how much fragmentation can actually occur in a deer carcass. So we went to Wyoming and shot 38 deer with lead-based bullets and x-rayed them at every stage to see exactly how much fragmentation occurs. 100% of those whole deer contain fragments. 74% contained more than 100 fragments. How are we doing on time? Anybody know that?
Yeah, 1 minute and 37 seconds.
Okay. All right. Well, there's an example of this radiograph. Boy, I'm not going to make it. There's an example of those same looking fragments in condors. We've had 12 cases of this in Arizona. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to go through this. The Arizona Game and Fish Department did a survey.
I'm going to add 5 minutes to both presentations.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Let me back up. Being fairly confident now that we were seeing a trend of exposure in the fall, we thought, well, we have to make sure that we have all our ducks in a row, our condors, as it were, and take this information to the Arizona Game and Fish Department, because the implications that we had observed were serious, especially with regard to hunting and lead-based bullets. So in 2003, the Arizona Game and Fish Department, after hearing our story and what we had collected, they did a survey and did some focus groups to find out how much of Arizona and Utah hunters actually were aware that lead poisoning was a problem. Only 23% of Arizona and 12% of Utah hunters knew there was a problem. 83% to 97% of them in Arizona and 78% to 98% in Utah said they were somewhat to very willing to take action to help the birds. Well, this is great because we were looking at voluntary measures. The lead reduction message, we obviously needed one voice training. We needed to have a credible organization, and actually, luckily in Arizona, Arizona Game and Fish is known as a credible organization, so that helped a whole lot. They didn't want to hear from our group or others perceived to be like us. Form a coalition of sportsmen's groups. We did that. We have the Arizona Deer Association. You can read the rest or go back online, it sounds like, and look at it later. but we have generated a lot of support for voluntary measures to reduce lead. The free non-lead program, Arizona Game and Fish, gave 2 free boxes of non-lead ammunition, premium Barnes Federal Premium loaded ammunition in 2005 and 6. The results are as follows. 2,400 big game applicants were eligible in 2005 and 1,400 in 2006. Basically found that 65% of the hunters participated in 2005, 60% participation in 2006. According to a 2005 survey, 81% of the program participants used the non-lead ammo on their hunt, and 60% of the successful hunters used it. What's that mean for fragmentation in those animals that were still shot with lead? Looking back at what we know from the blood, the lead study, fragmentation study, we expected 100% of coyotes to show lead because they're usually shot with fragmenting ammunition, high-powered 22, 250, 223, things like that. And we saw of carcasses, we collected 100% of those to contain lead. Mule deer, we expected 50% because we saw a 60% use of non-lead on the hunt. Of the deer we collected, only 67% showed fragments, just showing that it looks like it was working. 93% who harvested the deer said it performed as well or better than lead ammunition. 72% said they'd recommend it to others. 89% said they'd use it again if it was free. 56% said they would purchase this ammo on their own in the future. This is success. It's not enough success, as we've seen with the levels of exposure last year, but this effort and this message is working, and people are listening, and we are receiving some good response. 50% to 60% of the deer were harvested with non-lead ammo in these last 2 years. The free ammo program was successful at reducing the amount of lead available to condors, but unfortunately, because condors are such good scavengers, if there are even a few out there, some birds are going to show levels of exposure. That was a repeat. Sorry about that. You need to see this before we end here, and this is for all years 1999 through 2006. You see this reduction in 2005 of birds showing levels of exposure and birds that required treatment. This is, we're trapping every single bird several times a year to monitor their blood lead levels and treating them if they have high lead. How many birds would we have lost if we didn't treat them? And we see both our lowest level of exposure and our highest through the first 2 years of the bullet program. In 2005 and 2006 seasons and the 2006-2007 season, we had a 95% increase. 95% of our birds showing levels of exposure. 70% of the population had to be chelated. We're not out of the woods yet. We sampled this is a repeat. The key here is we're losing older birds, and we can't lose older birds if those birds are going to be successful in replacing themselves and breeding for 5 to 10 years. In the last 5 years, we've lost 20 birds, and 9 of those were to lead. Excluding lead, we would have only had 11 deaths. And mind you, these missing and unknown birds, a percentage of those were very likely, statistically, a part of the lead exposures. I think I'm going to cut this short. A 50% reduction of carcasses containing lead on the Kaibab is a result of an unprecedented effort by the Arizona Game and Fish Department that has earned the voluntary support of hunters. Whatever mitigating measures that are used, voluntary or mandatory, the key is going to be a high rate of compliance. So whatever it takes to get that compliance is what we need to do for condors and their recovery. The implications, however, are far greater than just condors. And for me, as a father and as a person who prides himself on the meat that I take home, it was a concern with me when I found that I was potentially feeding this to my kids. So this isn't just a condor issue. However, that's our area of expertise. This is what we're trying to accomplish is recovery of the condor, and we're going to have to get the lead out of the system in order to do that in Arizona. And it's very likely the same thing here. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Parrish.
Do we have time for questions? Or
yes, we do have time for questions. Are there any questions from the commission, or should we wait until later?
I'm for waiting for later, but I'd like you to pull up that while you got it up here. That first picture you showed of the Kaibab Plateau and the habitat for the condor.
Yes, sir.
The very first one.
It
showed the whole state.
Steve, can you select that?
The one with the little deals that showed the whole state on it.
Sure. Yeah, and we're roughly talking about the northern half of the state and the southern half of Utah.
Yeah, but I need you to clear something up in my mind.
Yes, sir. Not a problem. I hope I can. Sorry, I tried to jam way too much stuff in there. And it is a major difference between California and Arizona, is we're lucky to have a geographically isolated area like the Kaibab and a lottery-drawn tag holder that we can actually contact prior to the hunt. Is this the one you're talking about here?
Right there.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All your other slides showed a concentration like at the Kaibab Plateau where what is legitimately condor range.
Yes, sir.
And you got the GPSs on them, so you know that they're going up in some of them other areas and stuff. But on the outskirts, you're not trying to claim, and that's where I'm going with this thing, is we got some people, we've got an original condor habitat that we know what it is, and now we've got people claiming because one bird wanders off into another area that's habitat too, and we got to start doing the same thing in those areas. You're not doing that there, are you?
Showing you is exactly where the birds have been and the potential areas of exposure. We've had birds as far north as Wyoming, Flaming Gorge.
That's my whole point.
Yeah. Exactly.
You're not going to say that they got a banned lead in all them states between there and Wyoming because one condor went up.
We're scratching the itch, and the itch is right there.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Parrish.
Thank you.
Our next speakers, it's a team, Ronald Goodwin and Walt Manziel, and between them they represent the California Rifle and Pistol Association, El Cajon Gun Exchange, Gun Owners of California, and California Association of Firearm Retailers.
Who's first, gentlemen? You want to do 10 minutes apiece, or do you want to just total 20?
I'm here mostly.
Knowing you, Walt, you'll use the rest.
So we'll just start the clock at 20, and you guys figure it out.
Good morning. My name is Ron Godwin, and Mr. President, members of the commission, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address you. I'm here in a representative capacity and won't claim to have the knowledge that that the fellow in front of me did. He's a tough act to follow. You've heard much information as it relates to the survival of the California condor and the impact hunters have on this species. I'm here to discuss the possible impact that California's hunting community can have on the survival of the condor. Some of the reports you have heard indicate that the California condor is greatly threatened by the ammunition used by hunters that contains lead, lead that subsequently finds its way into the condor's bodies when they consume carrion containing lead fragments, and that the gut piles left after hunters have successfully harvested a game animal in the condor range are the source problem. As the commission charged with overseeing the health and proper management of California wildlife for the enjoyment of all Californians, we ask that you consider the significant impact of following a path that bans the use of ammunition containing lead by hunters. As you are aware, the only viable alternative to lead for centerfire hunting ammunition is copper. Presently, we have two manufacturers that make copper bullets, Barnes and Nosler. Those bullets are used by most of the name brand ammunition manufacturers when they produce their premium hunting ammunition. Also, these bullets are available for hunters who reload their own ammunition. And as a dealer, I can assure you that these things are not cheap. They are very pricey, and typically we will find that people that come in and buy them are usually using them on big game out of state. In fact, in some cases, out of the country. The main benefits of using these bullets is that they retain nearly 100% of their original weight after impact, and they expand extensively with very sharp pedals, which make them effective game stoppers. I understand that you folks have all been presented with handfuls of these bullets as samples. If anybody hasn't seen one, I've got a couple in my pocket. I'll be happy to show you. The point in bringing this up is that we have seen little or no attention placed on the consequences of using only these types of bullets and the effect they will have on condors who consume them. Data has proven that condors have died of copper poisoning, to say nothing of the potential for physical trauma as these bullets travel through the digestive tract. They have some very, very sharp edges on them. If in the future copper bullets are also targeted as harmful to the condor, we will be right back where we are today, discussing yet another ban, except that since today's technology and for the foreseeable future, technology has not provided an alternative to lead and copper for a rifle bullet, we would be looking at a ban on hunting, period. It seems to us that before the commission takes a position that will change the course of hunting that has existed for over a century, it should seriously consider the potential for unintended consequences of its actions with a thorough examination of the potential outcomes. Please understand that we do believe that these decisions should take place here at the commission and not in the legislature or the courts. As leaders in the sporting community, we welcome the opportunity to work with the commission to find a viable solution to this problem. But when the solutions seem draconian and filled with more questions than answers, it is incumbent on us to respond. It is agreed by everyone that a disruption of the potential pathway of lead to condors is a major step to see if hunters' ammunition is a source of lead poisoning for the condor. Before the commission considers the step of banning any type of ammunition, we would propose a solution that would make the hunting community partners in the process instead of cattle being led by the nose without explanation. You will probably hear that a program of requiring hunters to bury gut piles has proven ineffective in other states. Other states is not California. California hunters should not be judged guilty before being given a chance to act. A well-coordinated campaign by the Department of Fish and Game and all of the various organizations that represent hunters can be effective in California condor range. I've learned a tremendous amount. I'm going to depart from this just briefly today, talking to the folks that have shown up for this meeting. And I work in the industry. I talk to hunters 6-7 days a week sometimes, and the job that I do. And I will tell you that the knowledge level that we hunters as a group have on the potential impact of lead ammunition on a condor is very, very small. This is not something that's on our radar scope. I think that an education program is going to be something that's whether it's a mandatory program or a voluntary program, is going to be something that's unavoidable. It has to happen. And given that, hunters are conservationists. We don't want to see the condor go away. I think you'd have a very high rate of compliance amongst California hunters with whatever program you elect to pursue. Please do not fall prey into comparing this to the change to no lead ammunition for waterfowl hunting. Given the nature of waterfowl hunting and the collection of lead shot into ponds, lakes, and waterways, there was nothing else hunters could do to prevent the shot from concentrating in these areas. In the case of the Condor, Californians can disrupt the path of lead from ammunition of the Condors by burying or otherwise making the gut piles unavailable to the birds for consumption. The centering of today's discussion on lead ammunition ban notwithstanding, it would be a mistake to assume that the only source of lead is the gut pile. In fact, odds are that most bullets that successfully take game either do not remain in the animal or are buried in the meat that is taken out of the field for processing. Limiting the search for harmful sources of lead to ammunition will no doubt prove ineffective in the long run. We will be honest with you. We are concerned with the motivations of some of the advocates of a lead ban, and I will conclude with this explanation. Last fall, a meeting was held at the state capitol amongst all of the stakeholders, including the condor preservationists and the hunting community. After sitting through numerous presentations, there was a general agreement that a coordinated campaign to disrupt the pathway by burying gut piles would be a good thing to do. It was well understood that such a program would take quite a bit of planning and coordination for implementation. It was not a few short months after this meeting that a lawsuit was filed to ban the use of lead, and a bill was sponsored in the legislature to do the same. It seemed to us that cooperation had vaporized. We weren't even given the chance to try the program for one annual hunting cycle. As you can imagine, we felt that this may have been the original intent in the first place, a political and legal fight. We believe that the California Fish and Game Commission still has an opportunity to work with the hunting community instead of forcing it to go down the lead ban path. We will be happy to discuss these issues with you at any time. We hope that this hearing is a good place to start. And this testimony was submitted by Gun Owners of California. Sam Paredes is the executive director of that organization. And that concludes my statement.
Thank you, Mr. Goodwin. Do you have that in hard copy?
As a matter of fact, I do. I found out yesterday that you folks wanted 8 copies, right?
We do. Thank you. If you have it.
I do.
If you would be so kind as to hand that over to Sean over there.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Walt?
Thank you. Welcome to Commissioner Sutton. I'm Walt Mansell, representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. Mr. President, members of the Commission, members of department staff, for reasons that go far beyond the condor issue, this whole problem has become one of the most convoluted that I've ever dealt with from either side of the blanket in my 50-plus years of working on resource management issues in California. This should not be an anti-hunter versus hunter issue, but it has become so. I had a long talk with Chris yesterday out in the foyer. I had talked with Chris at some length when he was here before, 2 or 3 months ago before you. I have tremendous respect for the integrity of his information and the program he is running. And I think he's a very, very smart young man doing a viable, good job for his organization. With that being said, I want to just remind you briefly that California is not Arizona. We deal with a whole lot of different problems here, basically because of the tremendously higher rate of human habitation we have in the range of the condor. Arizona has a hunting season that's very short, and they draw tags so they know exactly who's there. We have an open season year-round in the condor range for deer and pigs and non-game animals. We have many, many thousands of residents and hunters that can literally walk out of their back door to hunt. When you go to the Kaibab, you plan a safari. Enforcement of any kind of regulation will be a tremendously difficult technical job. Cooperation of county district attorneys in this field may be very poor in some counties. I understand some of you may feel that passing of a lead ban will not, you know, the fact that it's tough to enforce is not a reason not to vote for it, but in realistic sense, it is a very difficult thing. The game wardens already have a whole lot on their plate to do. Let's look at a couple of the facts. We reiterate the concern of our previous speaker that there weren't very many public meetings, and you're involved very deeply right now in implementation of Marine Life Protection Acts. You've had Blue Ribbon committees. You've had stakeholder meetings up and down the coast. You've had all kinds of outreach to potential ocean users. You've had very little in the way of outreach from the department or the commission to hunting groups throughout the state. The former speaker alluded to one session of which time things fell apart. I am concerned, like you are, that the rearing of the lawsuit and the gross misrepresentation of the actual science of the case by the people filing that lawsuit, and even within the language of the lawsuit, has really thrown up a bar between we hunters and you, the commission, and they, the department, that ought to all work together to solve this issue. I feel very strongly that a regulation will not be of value to the condor in the long run in California. We want to reduce the lead available to the condor just like you do, but please don't take away one of the major ways we can do that by interdicting the pathway via burying gut piles or picking up and burying our non-game animals or whatever if we are given a chance to educate hunters. Why isn't this fact a part of the California Hunter Education Program stressed in every class to the young people throughout the state? And it's not, I don't believe. I haven't received anything that even mentioned it from the Hunter Education Instructors Association or the Department Hunter Education Coordinators. We talk about the educational thing failing. It hasn't even really been tried yet with an effective amount of force. And I feel very strongly that adoption of a regulation for California at this time, give us a chance to prove whether we can help over a significant period of time, two or three seasons. You know, how many years does it take to re-educate people in any area of their recreation or avocation? And we are certain, despite the comments in the department's statement, that enactment of this regulation would result in a substantial loss in hunting license sales within the area affected. I realize the department feels, and they drew a parallel with the duck hunting situation and the steel shot. The previous speaker alluded to some of the problems with that. We have not. You can't compare the deer hunter with the duck hunter. In some cases, they are the same person, but many, many deer hunters go afield one time a year for the opening weekend, and we never see them again. And those are the people we're going to lose as license buyers. They do very little damage to the resource. They harvest very few deer collectively. It's a great social occasion for their family or their group. And to bar them from going afield with Granddad's old 250 Savage or Uncle John's old 32 Winchester Special cannot be of benefit to sport hunting in California, nor to the resources. I think I spoke a whole lot, but I would ask that you question me, question anybody you wish, and question the speakers that appear before you. We have had a speaker or two that have appeared before you with professional credentials that have stretched the true science of the thing way out of bounds. I would ask that you question the expertise of these people and try to figure out what their real underlying motive is. There are some underlying motives in there, and it is not, honestly, to help the condor. With all due respect, I welcome your questions. Please feel free to question everybody that speaks to you on this issue, because a lot of misinformation has gone across this podium to you in the last several months. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Minnesell. Any questions from the
yes,
Commissioner Hannum?
A comment and then a question. Please don't draw a line between the hunters, the commissioners, and the department. Hunters are hunters. Four of the five of us up here are hunters.
Active.
All three of the hunters. Department over there are hunters. And having said that, your analogy to Grandpa's 30-30 or whatever it was, I totally am in sympathy with that. I'd love to see more people out hunting, doing it frequently or seldom. It's just a great way for people to get to the outdoors. My question is for Mr. Godwin. In your statement, sir, the comment is, data has proven that condors have died of copper poisoning, to say nothing, et cetera, et cetera. I've never seen anything like that.
The information was given to me by Sam Paredes, Gun Owners of California.
Given to you by whom?
Sam Paredes, the Executive Director of Gun Owners of California. That was in the prepared statement. With your permission, I'll go back and find out what his source for that information was and forward it to the commission.
Yeah, I agree with Commissioner Hanna's question there. Mr. Mansell and yourself both commented on the efficacy or lack thereof of other people's testimony. The condors have died by copper is a bomb that you just dropped on the commission. I have never heard anyone suggest that copper has caused the death of condors. So that peer-reviewed science is something we need, or we'd rather not hear about it for exactly the same reasons that you just protested the other people's testimony.
Understand completely. Let
Thank
me
you.
Research that, find out what, or excuse me, find out what research he
Thank
alluded
you.
To.
I'm not suggesting that it's wrong. We just need to know what it is.
Yes, sir.
I realize it was part of his statement, but that statement was made to me by a Department of Fish and Game biologist that presented a program to you about two or three sessions ago. I believe at Arcata.
Talking about Eric?
I think at Arcata. The department's initial EIS on this thing, if you read the fine print, it talks about two dead birds examined with elevated levels of copper. I do not know if the elevated levels of copper killed those birds, but it's in that document.
It was a fairly strong statement made to the contrary. So anyway, thank you, Walt. We will actually investigate that thoroughly. Tell you that. Any further questions from my fellow commissioners? Commissioner Sutton? Oh, I like saying that. That's nice.
Thank you, Mr. President. As one who lived through the transition between lead shot and steel shot for waterfowl hunting, I must say I have a distinct sense of deja vu because we heard many of the same arguments, pro and con. We heard that it would damage weapons. We heard that it was ineffective. We heard that it was more expensive and unavailable and so forth and so on, none of which really proved to be significant in the long run. And we are undoubtedly better off now in terms of the wildlife resource using steel shot. I guess my question for Chris is I read your report and the reports from Arizona. It seems to me that one of the conclusions you drew in your presentation is that even with free ammunition being available and high levels of voluntary compliance in Arizona, condors were still subject to pretty high levels of lead poisoning. So would you characterize this voluntary program as ineffective in removing lead from exposure from condors?
The ultimate goal, of course, is removing enough lead to allow the fatalities due to lead poisoning to be at a sustainable rate. And that being the leading cause of death now, obviously we haven't achieved our goal of doing that. Has it been unsuccessful in the first 2 years? I don't think you can say that, just like you can't with a reintroduced population in the first 2 years. It has been successful in educating the public, the hunting public specifically, and garnering their support. So for those who would say it's not going to work, I would hesitate to say, no, I'm not going to. A ban without education, without understanding, I don't think would work either. I think any program of mitigating the effect, the amount of lead in the field, is going to have a huge amount of education, and it's going to have to be trustworthy information. And if you don't establish that relationship with the hunting community and you polarize the sides for condor's sake, I think you may not make a dent. But we're pushing on. We have ideas. I didn't get to in the presentation the future of where we're going with this next, but we're trying to figure out how to have a blitzkrieg, if you will, of positive information of what hunters have done, how they have taken efforts into their own hands by purchasing it themselves or using what's available to them to actually make a difference. And I think that's the key. So has it been successful? Yes. Not as much success as we need to actually reduce it as the leading cause of death, but it has been successful.
I certainly agree with your last remark, Chris. I think a positive, proactive program by the hunting community, who I view in the main as being stewards of what they're doing, is the overwhelming best way to shortcut the camel's nose in the tent, you know, fear that a lot of people have regarding this this issue.
Yeah.
And the underlying motivations of some, apparently. With four members of the of a five-person commission being active hunters, it's somewhat doubtful that anyone who was seeking to ban hunting in the state of California would, at least during this tenure, have a whole bunch of success here.
Yeah.
However, protecting the condor would have a whole bunch of success here, I suspect. So, anyway, I think we can segue to the department.
I just want to respond as the fifth member who doesn't hunt. I have to make at least one comment that many Californians, including myself, honor and respect the traditions of hunters, and we don't need to post this as a non-hunter-hunter issue.
I'm sorry, I did not mean to suggest that.
I know you didn't, but enough comments have been made. I want to make sure that everyone's aware of that. Thank you.
The department.
Good morning, Commissioners. Sankey Master with the California Department of Fish and Game. Per your request at a previous meeting, we have provided you with an update on some information that I'd like to run through very quickly for you regarding this issue. One was kind of some results of voluntary education efforts. You've heard the Arizona results. There's some information here on our efforts to get the word out on burying the gut pile, you know, making sure to try make every effort to retrieve animals that has been shot, and also to encourage lead-free use on a voluntary basis. The other thing in the report is also a expanded summary of the types of ammunition and some of the cost ranges that you had requested at the last meeting. I do need to point out, though, that in the table towards the end of the first part of the report that lists the ammunition, there are some bullets there identified that would not be legal to use in, under the current California regulations. Those are the solids. By rule, they have to be expanding bullets, so those would not be legal in California under the current rules. Does the commission, I know you got this really late, so you may not have any questions at this moment. I would like to highlight also a couple of things we're working on. We are reviewing, still reviewing comments we did receive on the draft EIR. We are also, per the commission's request, evaluating an alternative condor zone. As you know, both in the EIR and the ISOR, we have the condor range identified by existing deer zone boundaries. We originally did that so that if it was implemented, our deer hunters would have a better understanding of where that is. There was some interest expressed by, I think, Commissioner Kellogg, identified that a lot of that area is actually currently not in condor range. Could we narrow it to focus more in condor range? We're currently looking at alternatives where we'll have that using roads and easily identifiable geographic lines, tighten up that boundary. We're currently in the process of coming up with a new version of that. We are also still evaluating some of the new science we heard at the Bodega meeting. Some of those papers are in press and are not through the peer review process yet, so we don't have full access to all the information yet, but we will be evaluating once we get our hands on it.
Sankey, do you have any indication as to the potential availability of some of these, I won't use the word alleged reports, but we're just hearing a lot about these things but haven't seen them, so it's difficult for us to get our hands on them. One would hope that the authors would realize that time is of the essence here, and we need to look at those papers as soon as possible. Are you getting any indication of their willingness to share their information?
Yeah, we're working on acquiring that. The issue is the peer review process of a scientific publication is a touchy process, and it's really not appropriate for them to release drafts in peer review while in peer review that may have to be changed, and all of a sudden we're out here quoting data. So it's really
I understand.
Difficult. We have seen the excerpts. You were presented with some of that information at the last meeting. We're waiting to get our hands on it to actually look at how they drew those conclusions. So that's part of our continuing effort to make full use of the any new science that we have out there on this subject. We'll also be developing any options the commission may want to add to the existing range of alternatives in both the EIR and the ISOR. And so we just wanted to give you an update of where we are on this. And if you have any questions or suggestions, we're ready and willing to listen. And
any questions? Commissioner Gustafson?
You know, I'm as always, interested in our public outreach. Excuse me. And there was a comment made by Walt that there hasn't really been a lot of outreach and education done by the department, and yet I see the literature that we have in here has gone to those tag holders since 2003. So yes. There has been some outreach. Any other efforts that you can tell us about?
Actually, we've had some nice cooperation from the U.S. Forest Service and the Condor Program folks, particularly in the southern part of the Condor Range, where they've actually gone out during deer season, particularly the opener, and made contacts with hunters and parties talking about the problem. There has been physical outreach. Every hunter who's gotten a tag in deer zone range in the last few years has received, included in their tag, is a notice explaining the situation, mm-hmm. and asking them to follow those principles to help break that pathway, which is, you know, taking animals out of the woods, using lead-free, burying gut piles, all those features.
Right.
So we have been very active in getting the word out. Unlike the Arizona situation, because of the nature of some of these tag zones, we don't every year know who those people actually
right.
are. So,
right.
But anybody who's gotten a tag, while we don't know who necessarily, they have gotten the information.
I have a question about that. No, please, go ahead.
And the survey indicates that they're aware of it. I mean, if these statistics are correct, they're somewhat aware of the issue.
Yeah, there has been, as you are aware, there have been reviews. Our hunters are aware. This is not a new issue. As you know, 2 years ago, we had this item before you, and ever since then, there have been updates. So the hunting community is generally aware of the problem, and we're continuing to enhance that. We have not gone to the lengths yet that Arizona has with, like, the free ammunition program. We've been looking at options there and how to do something similar.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we figure that out, we'll, of course, bring you something
to
share.
Commissioner Kellen?
This is what I've been talking about at every meeting in the last two or three meetings this issue brought up. Is this commission directed the department to participate in this outreach program for the last couple of years. Anybody who's looked at a set of hunting regulations or bought a deer tag in that area has been exposed to the problem we have with the California condor. The problem is in California. I mean, I commend what they're doing in Arizona. They're doing a lot of good work with the studies and stuff. Is that we still don't have any factual results of what effect that has had on the condors in that range, the education process, and what the hunters have actually done themselves to help eliminate that problem in that range. I'm glad to hear you say, Sonke, that you're going to further define the condor. That's a huge issue to me. At some point, if we do a ban on lead in the condor range, it's important to me that we confine it to the condor range. And my thought is that it at least start out being a temporary ban so we can do studies and find out if it is. At this point, there still hasn't been any proof that that's the only place that these condors are getting lead from and being poisoned and the blood lead showing up in their blood. With us having any kind of a ban at all, in my opinion, it should be a temporary ban until we have factual proof that it made a difference. And so that being said, that's why I think it's important that we don't expand it beyond the condor range, that we keep it right in that range where we've got a factual place. And you know, this divisiveness between hunters and non-hunters and stuff like that, that's part of the world today. And we had a person stand up in Arcata from one of the groups that's suing us over not making a decision on this issue, who made the statement that's on, if you want to go back to these films that everybody's talking about, that their goal is to ban hunting in California, ban lead in the state of California, and eventually hunting. So there are people out there like that, and that is not going to ever go away. And so to think that it is ridiculous. So we just need to take this responsibly, take our time, and just like we did on the marine protected areas, and do it right.
Commissioner Hanna, your light is on.
The expanding bullets, is this one of them?
Yes.
So that's legal in California?
Yeah. Yeah, the only, it has to be soft nose or expanding to enhance, you know, the lethality of the bullets. I mean, we want hunters to humanely and efficiently kill animals when they shoot them, so the bullet has to perform that way. One of the things we do need to look at, and we have not found a whole lot of information, while the copper expanding bullets are clearly very lethal ammunition, we're not sure about the solids. I mean, traditionally they haven't been, but these new bullets that are solid are moving much faster, and most of you know, familiar, that has an effect. And that's one thing we want to look at is could some of these solids be lethal? And that's something we just don't know. But currently they would not be legal.
Commissioner Sutton.
One of the things you learn when you work in enforcement for any length of time is the importance of voluntary compliance. We obviously don't have enough wardens to ensure compliance of 100% compliance of any regulation, much less something like this. I guess I have a couple of questions. I mean, I find the Arizona program persuasive in terms of distributing free ammunition. What an incentive to use, especially in view of the fact that for the moment, non-lead ammunition is more expensive. So I would certainly be in favor of that kind of experimental program in California. And other management measures that the department could implement without any additional authority, such as in Arizona, you've got a special tag required for hunting in that particular area, reasons unrelated to condors. One could easily transition to that type of management in the condor zones here, I suppose. I guess the second question is for Chief Foley, as much as anybody. When we went to Steel Shot for waterfowl hunting, enforcement was relatively easy because all you had to do was carry around a big veterinarian's magnet, steel being magnetic and lead not. In this case, it's obviously going to be more difficult because you don't have you have two metals that are both non-magnetic. And it's more difficult, as has been demonstrated, to tell the difference in the field between lead and copper. Recognizing, of course, from an enforcement perspective, that you can't just ban the use of ammunition in the field. You have to ban the possession of ammunition in the field. That's what was done with steel, with lead shot, and for waterfowl hunting, and that would almost certainly have to be the case here as well. So, Chief Foley, have you thought about the difficulties or not of enforcing such a regulation?
Yes, thank you. We all know that it's going to be very difficult, especially right now. We don't have any current method of using a magnet, or there's no technology where you can stick a round in and find out if it's copper, that it's just copper-coated with a lead core or not. The only way we think we can enforce it currently, and I'm certainly open to suggestions, but it would be for the people that get the ammunition. It would have to be manufactured ammunition. It couldn't be, people couldn't load their own. It'd have to be manufactured ammunition, and they'd have to bring the box with them so that the rounds could be compared with the box. And I'm sure some people are going to figure out to put, you know, lead core into a different manufactured box, but we'll have to deal with that along the way. But it's currently very perplexing to us as to how we might be able to control it.
Any further questions by the commission? Sankey, I think as we've have been expressing our concern as a commission to make certain that both the department and the commissioner are on a relatively strict timeline, given the fact that there are external forces, not only assembly Manava's bill, but of course the suit from the center, or NRDC, I guess it is. What timeline would you propose, and what would be the specificity with respect to that timeline? Can you give us a presentation, for example, with much more in-depth and a specific timeline, say perhaps in June?
Yes, I think we could.
Could you elaborate a bit on that?
In what way?
As to just what you would approximately give us.
Well, one of the things we obviously would look at is once we do get our hands on the science that's been put before you and are able to scrutinize it ourselves, and incorporate and develop alternatives that you may have, that would tell us how long it's going to take to put that timeline together. I can't presuppose how long it's going to take. Depends on what you, if there are any additional alternatives, you know, whether you want us to wait to get our hands on this science or you go with what you have.
Those are decisions that we could make once you presented to us your alternatives for analysis.
Yeah, I mean, our goal, again, is to provide you with the most current and in an unbiased fashion as possible, give you the facts and give you reasonable alternatives that we think will produce a desired result. As you know, there are many issues here. The data clearly suggests, and being a hunter myself, hunters understand the problem and they want to do something about it. But they want to make sure if they make a sacrifice that it's going to produce an effect, a positive effect. That's what they need to know. That's what you'll see in that survey data. They're willing to do it, but only if it's going to have a real effect and they're just not a scapegoat for some other problems. So that's the kind of information we need to make sure we organize and present to you in a way that, you know, will make you comfortable with the decision, whichever way you're going to go.
I'm sure you understand, and certainly we all do, and Commissioner Gustafson has probably another comment on this right now, but the perhaps even grave importance of both the department and the commission being on a timeline and being on a track that is very public and open to discussion by the public at points all along that timeline, so that those who are concerned about this issue, whether they are an anti-hunting subgroup of the population, or whether they are, in my opinion, the vast majority of hunters who are genuine stewards of the environment and who seek to solve problems once they become, as you articulately say, aware of this and want to take personal action, so that all of this group of stakeholders, if you will, are in fact comfortable that we are on a decision tree, if you will, and we're progressing along in a workmanlike fashion. We may get, as you know, somewhat derailed by these exogenous forces that are happening to us. The NAVA bill is sailing through the legislature at this point in time, could conceivably be enacted this year. It is imperative that we do all of our homework and progress on a decision timeline so that we're prepared for should the inevitability occur that takes effect before, in fact, our decision has all the niceties, the scientific niceties and meets and bounds that actually satisfy us in a scientific way as opposed to political science, which may be sailing through the legislature at this juncture. I do not, by that comment, mean to demean the NAVA bill at all. I think the thinking there is very good.
Yeah, and you make a very good point, Commissioner Rogers, and you heard several speakers talk about the importance of getting buy-in by the hunting community and everyone. And that's what we're trying to achieve, is that the information you make the decision on is compelling, which for whatever decision you make, so that everybody says that's the right choice. And that's what we're trying to do for you.
Commissioner Gustafson?
You know, I just had a couple comments. Not being a hunter, sometimes I don't understand the slippery slope fear that I hear when we're talking about this issue, that we're going to take from this and go to the full extreme of banning hunting in the state of California. That I can't imagine anyone in the state not understanding the importance of hunting biologically and in our resources. So I have a hard time understanding that fear, and so I tend to look at this more as, is, you know, lead is a toxin. Lead is something in the environment that we'd probably prefer not to have over time. And so let's look at it from that perspective. That's how I come to this, sitting here as a public policy maker for the state. Anyway, that's just kind of an aside. In this report in June, I think what's important for the commission is to be very clear about those things that we want from the department, because where we find ourselves often disappointed or not having full information is because we haven't had time to discuss and really flesh out what it is we need as a commission and give appropriate direction to the department and what will be in this staff report and timeline. For instance, are there things that we can do in a phased approach now under our current authority in a timeline, again, that whether it's taking the PLM lands and making that a mandatory, you know, versus a voluntary lead ban in those areas, the depredation permits, the Department of Wildlife areas, are there approaches here that phase this in certain areas? Is that valuable or not? I don't know, but it's certainly something that I'd like to hear about. And again, greater public education and outreach to the hunters, and I guess to try to persuade people that we don't need to react to this as some sort of slippery slope. This
Thank
is a toxin.
Thank you for those comments. This is very well said. Director Browder?
Mr. President, Commissioners, and Commissioner Gustafson, in particular, I think that you've captured some questions that we need to broaden kind of the our representation to the commission. This started as a regulatory review of big game hunting regulations. Quickly and appropriately, and from the very first day of the emergency petition, has also been, what do we do to conserve, restore condor populations? And I think the PLM issues, we have had voluntary correspondence there. You had a major ranch, and at the last bodega meeting talked about how we could use the PLMs on those large footprint landscapes. And I look at the military reservations within Condor Range that also have hunting programs. I look at depredation permits. So we will, in June, bring back to you some of those, what I would refer to as potentially administrative within the authority of the department or parallel fish and game authorities that could get to the conservation of condors by getting the lead out, and look at gut piles potentially as an asset instead of a potential liability, because I think what Chris brought from Arizona, recognizing it's not all parallel, is these animals are, you know, a carrion forage feeder with broad ranges potentially, and we don't have the landscape. That's not me. We don't have the landscape to provide the natural attenuation of antelope and tule elk and other massive plains animals that existed when the condors were flourishing. So how can we look at this from the standpoint of, you know, having the hunting and the byproduct of the hunting be a potential, you know, asset to the condor, not a liability? And we'll bring some of those ideas back to you in June.
Thank you very much, Director Browder. We have two public speakers here, but before we have those, I might make a comment to amplify something that Commissioner Gustafson just said. I personally am very aware of the slippery slope. Every year I shoot in England, Ireland, and Scotland, and I'm a member of an organization in the UK called SOS, which is Save Our Shooting. There is a very slippery slope going on in the UK, because fundamentally urban dwellers who don't really understand country life and fundamentally are actually almost like in a class warfare against it are out to stop shooting. And there, if they had something like lead to work on, they certainly would take that. And their base motivation is definitely to end hunting in the UK. So that is not just a fantasy or something that may be out there. In the UK, it definitely is, and it's very well organized.
And I don't deny that, Richard. I think my point being that there's people who oppose or support a whole lot of crazy ideas out there, and we can't react to those people. We've got to do proper public policy, and so fear of what someone is going to do down the line is just not why I'm here. I'm here to make good public policy that holds true now.
Well said, Commissioner.
That's what I wanted to say. I'm proud of the way that this commission is handling this issue. I mean, we've got some groups that didn't get their way right off the get-go and filed lawsuits and stuff like that. They're the same ones that got sponsorship for the bill that's before the legislature. But we're doing the right thing, and we need to realize we're doing the right thing and feel good about doing the right thing without having to worry about the threat of a stinking lawsuit against it. And what Mike said, and Sonke's comment about hunters want to be a part of the solution and not continue to be a part of a problem, but they need to have some kind of information that shows that they're making a difference. And that's what the future information that we're going to get is going to show. And what Mike said about being involved in back in the banning of lead shot on the waterfowl nationwide made a huge difference. And I was one of the people that was fought that tooth and nail. I refused to shoot steel shot in my guns. But I did have opportunity to get new guns where I would do it, though, so that was a good part. But I quit hunting for years on waterfowl, and a whole bunch of people did the same thing. But as a result of the positive effect that has had, I think hunters learned a huge, huge, huge lesson. And now they're much more willing to participate in trial programs and voluntary efforts to in the condo area to make this thing work and see what's going to happen. So with that, let's hear some public comment.
Great comment. Thank you, sir. We have two public speakers. 5 minutes, please.
Okay, our two public speakers are Pamela Flick, followed by Bill Gaines.
Good morning, Commissioners. Pamela Flick with Defenders of Wildlife California Program Office. And I think there might be some confusion, but just to clarify, Defenders of Wildlife is not a party to the lawsuit against the Commission and the Department. It was our understanding that when the petition was denied that this process would be looked at under the 2007 mammal hunting regulations, and so we thought we would not join that lawsuit. As you know, well over $40 million has been spent on the California Condor Recovery Program, and despite its 15 years of reintroduction efforts, there's still no viable population. There's somewhat rare consensus that I think you've all heard among the recovery team members and the condor biologists that the recovery efforts will never succeed without eliminating lead availability to condors. While we applaud the efforts made by state, the federal government, conservation organizations like Project Gutpile, and private individuals to educate hunters and to encourage the use of non-lead ammunition, these voluntary measures have not been sufficient to address the lead problem. In fact, as we heard from Mr. Parrish, three condors have already died this year in Arizona, despite the unprecedented voluntary effort in that state, and fully 70% of the condor population in Arizona has had to be treated via chelation. And if I was reading the chart correctly, that's the highest percentage of treatment that they've seen in the last 10 years. This kind of extensive management is not indicative of a successful recovery effort, and it never will be. Since reintroduction began in 1992, at least 13 condors have died from lead poisoning, not to include the others that have died from other causes, including predation, which could have been caused by the poisoning itself, or the unknown birds that have never been brought in for necropsy. And dozens more have had this invasive, expensive chelation treatment, which can run $5,000 to $40,000, my understanding, per treatment. 13 birds may not seem like a big deal, but when we're talking about a species that has been down to 22 individuals, every death is a major blow to the recovery efforts. We believe that there's ample evidence supporting the assertion that lead ammunition is having devastating effect on the highly endangered California condor. Studies have linked the isotope signature of the lead in free-flying condors to that of ammunition commonly used in their range. Lead levels in condors also tend to be especially elevated during the fall, which coincides with hunting season, as we saw in Mr. Parrish's presentation. It's estimated that more than 30,000 carcasses or gut piles are left in the field annually, representing a significant source of carrion with potential to contain lead fragments that can be ingested by condors. We must utilize this best available science to make important decisions affecting California condor recovery. It's imperative that the Commission act on the info you currently have before you to eliminate this cause of lead poisoning, although it may not be the only cause. It clearly is causing jeopardy to the species, and this is in direct violation of the Endangered Species Act. There's a question about the copper deaths. On page 12 of the department's original environmental documentation, the second bullet point speaks to that fact. The department knows of two deaths of California condors where copper lead levels were copper levels were considered high and possibly responsible for death, and additionally two other birds. The department is understanding that copper is less toxic than lead, and copper bullets are less likely to fragment than lead bullets. However, copper toxicity should be investigated further. I think it's worth mentioning that condors feed in groups, and so if they're feeding on one carcass that was shot with lead, multiple birds can be poisoned by eating that one carcass. In Mr. Godwin's presentation, he showed the one copper bullet that doesn't fragment. It's made to not do that. So if there is a tainted carcass, possibly one condor out of the group can be poisoned, but not the whole group. I also want to be clear that Defenders is not an anti-hunting organization, and we feel that hunting, big game hunting especially, positively impacts condors by providing food sources to the birds. We just need to get the lead out of it. We strongly agree with Commissioner Gustafson's point about lead being toxic. Lead has been removed from gasoline, paint, cookware, water pipes, and even shot for waterfowl. And it's time to remove yet another source of lead in our environment for the health of condors, other wildlife, and humans. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Flicker.
Oh, I also wanted to mention that I gave to Sean a list of ammunition that Assemblymember Nava's office put together. And I know that you've heard that lead is much more expensive. They found that in some cases the non-lead ammunition is either the same price or even cheaper in some instances.
Thank you, Ms.
May I ask a quick question?
Please.
You mentioned 30,000 gut piles. Is that all over California?
I believe I found that information in the department's environmental document, and
so that's California.
I believe that's carcasses and gut piles, carcasses that lost game. Is that correct?
So that comes from deer tags.
Let me make a clarification. There's a couple of points here I think that's very important. We encourage you to, of course, read the EIR. We put a lot of energy into it. What the EIR does is reviews literature that has been published in one form or the other. Things that are in the document aren't necessarily what we believe in. As a matter of fact, there's an analysis in there. The department, when this issue really started coming up, contracted with Dr. Fry to do an assessment of where this lead might be coming from and the exposure. The report, unfortunately, made some estimations that we think were a little too extreme and unfounded. In that report, Dr. Fry estimated 30,000 gut pile or carcasses, undefined, whether it's a gut pile or a whole animal, it does make a difference. So there's some critical review in there by the department of these various literatures. And I also wanted to clarify on the copper. No condors in California have been known to die from copper. That's a fact. What it says is two that did die happen to have also high levels of copper. The toxicity of copper in condors is not well known. We don't know why the birds died. They just happen to also have high exposure level. That's a very important distinction to keep in mind. And one of the efforts we do in the EIR is to give you as an unbiased and objective evaluation of the various forms of literature and facts that are out there. or interpretations. That's what we try and achieve in the EIR. So it's very critical to read that. And if you have questions, we're more than happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Flick. Your presentations are always interesting and informative, but I would recommend that when you're pointing to places in the documents that you refrain from calling them bullet points. It's probably a good idea.
Bill Gaines.
Mr. President, members of the commission, and we'd also like to welcome Mike Sutton to the dais as well. It's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Bill Gaines. I'm president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. We would like to start off by saying that we do not outright support a lead ban in the Condor Range. However, we do believe that hunters, as our nation's first environmentalist, and our nation still our best stewards of our nation's natural resources, both non and non-game, should not outright oppose a lead ban at this time in the face of mounting evidence which suggests that lead bullets may be a cause of condor mortality. Would like to make a couple of recommendations to the Fish and Game Commission today. I'm very pleased that many of these recommendations have already been talked about, which is very positive. First recommendation has to do with the time frame for the commission taking action on such a ban. We are very concerned about Assembly Bill 821, Pedro Nava's legislation, that would statutorily ban lead in the Condor Range. This is an issue that should be dealt with by the Fish and Game Commission as a regulation. That is not something that should be dealt with in the legislature based on emotions and not based on science, as it will be done here. The longer the commission delays in taking action on this issue, the more that bill is going to move. As you very well know, that bill is already on the assembly floor. As long as the commission fails to act, that bill is going to continue moving. We believe that if the commission does take action on this based on science, that it will be able to kill that bill in the legislature and maintain this as a regulation as opposed to a statutory requirement. If the commission does choose to adopt a lead ban, we'd like to make two strong suggestions that the commission consider. A, as Jim Kellogg already pointed out and as Zonkey Master also talked to, that the commission do enact a ban only in the area of the A-zone south where condors are documented to have been. The current proposal, as you know, would ban lead in the entire A-zone south. A large portion of the northern part documentation has never been made where the condors actually have been there. Secondly, if the commission does enact a ban, that it be specifically stated that it's a temporary ban and that evidence be gathered as much as possible during that ban period in order to confirm or deny that lead bullets may be the culprit. We do believe that at this time, in face of mounting evidence, although we don't believe that there's 100% evidence that suggests that lead bullets are the prime culprit, but that the only way that lead bullets may be vindicated as a source of lead for condor mortality may be to put the ban in place temporarily, do intense evaluation and monitoring during that period, and bring the ban back to the commission for consideration with additional science. Finally, we too are concerned. It was mentioned earlier today that there has been a little bit of a failure of outreach by the commission on this issue. We would agree. We've seen many, many stakeholder groups up and down the state dealing with the MLPAs and the marine protected areas, for example. We've only been a party to one stakeholder group dealing with a lead bullet ban, and I can promise you that banning lead bullets in the Condor Range is every bit as devastating to many hunters as banning fishing in some of those marine protected areas may be as well. Finally, we do remain concerned about the cost and availability of non-toxic bullets. We would urge the commission to work with the department and others to try to find funding sources that can assist hunters in obtaining these bullets for a reasonable cost. And lastly, being that I've represented the waterfowl community and still do for almost two decades, I would like to make a comment in regards to making the nexus between non-toxic shot for waterfowl and non-toxic bullets for deer and big game in the Condor Range. The non-toxic ban, or the ban on lead shot for waterfowl, was a nationwide ban. It allowed the federal Remingtons, Winchesters, and so forth that make waterfowl loads to react to a large audience, to have the volumes of scale that would help make their R&D costs and so forth, and to spread those out to where they could keep the cost of those of that shot at a relatively lower level. This ban, of course, would be in a very, very narrow portion of the country, in a very, very narrow portion of their sales range, if you will. So keeping the cost down on this, I don't think we can compare this to the ability to keep the cost down on non-toxic waterfowl loads. And lastly, the ballistics of shotgun bullets, or shotgun pellets, I should say, for waterfowl are nowhere near as complex as trying to maintain good ballistics when you're making non-toxic lead bullets. And if anybody has any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them now.
Any questions from the commission? Yes, Commissioner Sutton.
Bill, I appreciate your testimony. Very well spoken. The only thing I find fault with is your fishing analogy. This is not, if we were to mandate the use of lead, of non-lead ammunition in this region, it would not be analogous, in my view, to banning fishing or implementing a marine reserve, but instead just simply changing a gear type. We're not banning hunting. We wouldn't be banning big game hunting, just simply requiring a more environmentally friendly gear, if you will. And that's the fishing analogy. And my question for you is, if the commission, your testimony seemed to suggest that if the commission were to mandate the use of non-lead ammunition, you would favor the distribution of free ammunition to hunters?
Certainly we would favor the distribution of free ammunition, at least to some extent, maybe helping those hunters out with the cost, maybe, you know, paying down the price of the bullets or so forth. Not necessarily maybe free. Free would be great, but if that couldn't be done, if they could just help assist them in the ability to pay for them, that'd be great. You look at the cost of chelating these birds, for example. I think it was said that they're $5,000 to $40,000 per bird. Well, if the anticipated benefit is every bit as much as a lot of people think it's going to be, if some of those dollars could be geared towards helping to make non-lead bullets available, you know, out in the condor range, that may be a wiser use of those monies as opposed to trying to treat the birds after the fact.
Your point's well taken. I suspect we could buy cases and cases of ammunition for the cost of chelation. And I also think, Mr. President, that there's a high likelihood that we could find private money to help subsidize a free ammunition program.
I think there's no question of that.
I think if you were to help the hunters with the availability and the cost of this, it would be much more widely accepted.
I think it would probably be even easy to find private funding from NGOs or other organizations for the education effort, which perhaps would be even more important. Commissioner Hanna.
Heretofore, I've not been in favor of subsidizing hunters' bullets, giving them free bullets, but Mike made a very good suggestion. If we could get private funding, however, I would want it to be done through the retailers in Condor Country so that we would say to them, you buy the bullets, we'll buy them from you. Otherwise, those guys have just lost a market.
I would fully agree with that, Commissioner Hanna.
I also, there's another, I think, point that's important here. And for many hunters and users of firearms who may actually be contributing to this because, you know, it could be a pig that someone shot that, you know, goes out there and is preyed upon by the condor. The nexus for education is often in the gun store. I mean, those of us who are hunters and shooters don't walk into a gun store, buy something, and walk out. We walk into a gun store, and we enjoy being in the gun store, and we talk to the people who run the gun store because they're normally very compassionate and interesting people who share our passions with respect to the sport that we're about. And it would be incumbent upon us to set up a situation where the gun stores themselves are very much behind this and very much proponents. So those suggestions from down the table are really delightful to me. Thank you.
If I could quickly, I've been around long enough to very well remember when non-toxic shot was put in place for waterfowl, and it was vehemently opposed by just about everybody who hunts waterfowl throughout the nation when that happened. Now that some better loads are out there, you've got, you know, the high-density non-toxic shot and so forth, many of which believe is better than lead shot ever was. It's widely accepted. It's a little bit more expensive. The cost is still a concern, but it is widely expensive by the waterfowl hunting public. I believe if you suddenly made lead shot available for waterfowl and legal for waterfowl again, many people probably would say, I don't want to use it. I'd rather use some of the new loads that are out there. Point being, I did look at the presentation a little bit earlier today, and I guess I was very pleased to see the high percentage of acceptance, if you will, by those hunters that did use the non-toxic bullets within the Arizona range of the condor. So that's promising. I think if you can make those bullets available for a reasonable cost, the hunters, again, being our nation's number one stewards of our game and non-game species, I believe that they would embrace the new shot.
I agree with your comment. I think it's critical for everyone to understand that entirely removing lead from the condor range is not necessarily the point here. What you're trying to do is reduce it to the point where the population is sustainable and viable. on its own without chelation. And so that may be a fraction, some perhaps large fraction of lead bullets that are out there, but we don't probably need to get them all. It's probably true. That's just supposition on my part. Any further comments?
Just briefly, in terms of finding private sources of funding to help with this, there is a precedent. Pamela can comment further, but Defenders of Wildlife has long compensated ranchers, sheep ranchers in the Rocky Mountains for their losses to grizzly bears as a means of subsidizing and encouraging greater, more widespread acceptance of grizzly bear recovery. Wolves in Yellowstone. There are a number of examples of private subsidies that help promote these programs that I think we should look to for examples.
Ms. Flick, do you have a comment on that?
I do, just a short one. Thank you, Commissioner Sutton. We do, as you said, have a long history of compensating for losses, and Defenders has already actually started seeking funds for either non-lead bullets, either through this process or through the legislation by Mr. Nava that you all are fully aware of, which also has a non-lead ammo subsidy portion of it, which could be funded by federal or private. Now, there's no state funding. We took some amendments, so no state funding would be available for that. I'm heartened to hear that also some, seeking of funding for education, posters, brochures, et cetera, for ammo shops, and that's something we can certainly look into and would be happy to. Of note, the National Fish and Wildlife Federation was just recently looking for proposals, and one of their main species of concern was the California condor. And we put in a pre-proposal for that. But because both processes had not come to completion, we felt that we would wait until we know definitively what the decision is made, and then we will go forth and look for funding for that.
Thank you for your organization's enlightened position. We need to sort of move along a bit here. Commissioner Gustin, do you have a comment?
Well, no, I just wanted to get back to the summary of what action we want from the department at that June.
Please.
What's going to be in that report? What's our timeline? That we're kind of looking at this point based on the comments you've seen. It's kind of ambiguous to me what we're going to see in June, and I want to make sure the commission and
Thank
the department
you.
Are on the same page on that. And I didn't mean to cut comments short with you guys, but it was, what are we looking at here?
And when making those comments, would you be so kind as to be specific with respect to the environmental documents?
Yes. My list so far, just so we're all can come to an agreement here, is you've requested timeline for action. That will be included in the June report.
And that's related to the environmental document?
Yes. That is the document that is most constraining in terms of action.
Precisely.
Because of the 45-day comment period, and tends to be more extensive comments. I think there's a need to further clarify the causes of condor deaths in California. We keep hearing references, and we're mixing Arizona, California. I think it's caused some confusion.
I think that's fair.
Suggestion only, just to clarify, because there's a lot of misrepresentation or misspoken words about actually what birds we're talking about, and the known deaths versus what's assumed to have caused. There's a big difference there. The other thing I have is options on how to get the lead out using administrative, regulatory, or policy options that we currently have. Ryan mentioned several. In addition, we're also asking all people getting depredation permits in condors to use lead-free. We are doing that now, lead-free ammo. So that was the other thing I...
Would you include timing in those options?
Yes. Yeah, each of these have their
phasing,
own sense of timing.
Example.
Yes. Then, based on various comments, I'm making the assumption you'd be interested on an update on the best available science, clarifying on that, what we do in fact know versus what's been asserted. You know, I know that sounds rather nebulous, but we want to enhance what you have in the current EIS based on some of the new information that we've just received. And then I understand there was a great deal of interest in looking at options and possible mechanisms for a ammunition program, either free or subsidized, using both possibility of inside and outside a state system program, whether it's NGOs or whatever, to help kind of facilitate a transition or, if it, in a non-regulatory way, encourage the use of lead-free. So that's my list right
There's
now.
There's actually something I would add to it immediately, and I'll, Commissioner Kellogg, I'll get that in just a moment, and that would be the department's ideas on an expanded outreach program, not only to the gun stores and the shooters themselves, but perhaps as a general public understanding of that which we are about here, because remembering that it is the general public who is precipitating. Who is a lot of the precipitation of this. I mean, we ourselves are precipitating this and would have done so as soon as we had the scientific evidence. There was a nexus. But having said that, there's this exogenous variable out there, which is the external forces that fundamentally don't have a whole bunch to do with going to a gun store or getting a permit to shoot something. So it's not just a hunter education program and a purveyor of materials for that activity. Mr. Kelton?
Salky, I might have missed it, and you might have mentioned it, but if you did, I did miss it. One of the things that you need to do is come back with a definition of the range, what is actual range of the condor, not just somebody's guesstimate that it's beyond what it really is. So.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have mentioned that's already on a previous commitment, and I mentioned earlier we're in the process.
I thought you were just.
Yeah, I will come back with that too.
Thank you,
Commissioner Gosses.
And maybe I'm pushing a little hard here, but is the department ready to? Are you considering that you're going to be recirculating? Are you prepared to say that you need to recirculate this document? I mean, or do you still need 30 days to assume that?
Let me put it this way. If the commission does, in fact, want a modified condor range to consider as an option, it must be recirculated.
Okay.
That alone will trigger recirculation.
Okay.
And I won't speak to the other items because we're still looking at all that. But that item, for us, for you to consider that in your ISOR, your regular APA document, we have to modify and redraft the EIR and recirculate based on that.
Yeah, well, and I think you're hearing that from the commission today.
Yes, I'm assuming that
we're
based on what I'm hearing.
That's my assumption as well. Any further comments? John, did you have some comments?
I think we are.
Staff just wants to remind the commission that the existing public notice on this regulatory issue had adoption set for our teleconference call in April. Of course, we missed that, and commission knew we were going to miss that, so the department. So at this stage, public notice does not give another adoption date, and down the line, we will have to do another notice with a date certain adoption date. And I just wanted to put that out, remind the commission. I don't believe we can set a date today.
It seems to me, if I may, that we will have a much finer handle on that at our June meeting. And I suspect that we would want to, if it's the commission's pleasure, set those dates at that time. Does that work with everyone?
If I could jump in for a second, yeah, that will work the way I'm seeing it. The other question that you might want to look at is a date for implementation or effectiveness. So that's another thing that's probably not adequately noticed now.
What would we need to do to have ourselves in good position by our June meeting?
My understanding is actually the commission could even make a motion for when you wanted adoption to happen, and there's ways of working through the system on how we're going to do that. So, I mean, the main thing is at the June meeting, I think some decisions can be made on directing staff to do and re-notice on a date of adoption and public testimony.
I would submit then that perhaps from an information content perspective and having as good a decision as we can, that we probably should put that off until June would be my suggestion. Is that comfortable with the commission? Okay. Moving on, then. Thank you, everyone who participated in this. Very interesting discussion. Why don't we take a 10-minute break? Let's reconvene at 10:30. I'm sorry about all this.
No.
But you've got to get up and go, don't you?
No, I canceled my flight.
Which means sit down. John, do you want to take it away? Okay, here we go.
We are going to start with item 12 back at the top of the agenda for today. Announcement of results from executive session. Deputy Attorney General Bill Cunningham.
Thank you. Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General and Counsel for the California Fish and Game Commission. Mr. President, members of the Commission, I would like to report out a report from executive session and indicate that yesterday during our lunch break we did meet in executive session pursuant to Government Code Section 11126, and we used that opportunity to talk both about some of the cases currently in litigation as identified on our agenda, as well as to consider two licensing actions that had been earlier heard by a designated hearing officer on your behalf, and decisions on both of those licensing actions were made. I would like to report out that the decisions on both of those actions are the only actions that were taken during that matter and are as follows. In the matter of Mr. Alan Well, who had appealed for a transferable lobster operator permit, that appeal was denied. In the matter of Mr. Richard Merkovich, who had appealed a request for a transferable market squid vessel permit, that request was granted. And that's all I have to report, Mr. President.
Thank you. Item 13. I'm sorry, any questions from the Commission? Item 13.
And we have no public speaker cards on 12. Item 13, discussion and possible adoption of proposed changes to subsection 7.50B91.1, Title 14, regarding Klamath Trinity River Salmon Regulations. Sankey Mastrup of the Department has some words on that.
Yes, Commissioners, I actually will start out with a question on how you want me to handle this item. There's a very lengthy set of regulatory changes that we've been discussing over the last several meetings. In your packet is a summary of the Department's preferred recommendations for each of the items. If you're fine with that, I will not review them item by item. It's your pleasure. You know, the good news is what are the Department's preferred alternative on the salmon regulations is essentially full fishing within the quotas defined by the PFMC, and it's going to be a good salmon season by adopting these regulations. If you have any specific questions or you prefer a different approach,
well, Sankey, unlike some other issues, we actually did get this in plenty of time to read it, and thank you very much. I would submit that we have had it in time. How does the rest of the Commission feel? And if so, do I have a motion?
So moved.
Do you want to read the motion, John? So that we can get it into the record?
I'll turn to it.
Yep. Page 13.
Suggested motion is fish and game pursuant to the authority vested in sections 200, etc., in the several sections here, and it's all will be in the record, to implement, interpret, and make specific sections 200 plus several other sections. Hereby amend section 7.5B91.1, Title 14 of the California Code of Regulations regarding Klamath Trinity River Salmon Regulations. Please note the regulatory language will be included as an appendix in the Commission Office Master Minutes.
Do I hear a second?
Second, but I also have a question.
Yes. Is there any commentary or questions? Sankey has one as well. Commissioner Hanna?
On any of these, and this one specifically, I noted on it, if I could see a map, if there would be a map included with this to know where these places are. And the other question I had was... Is there any normal spawning in the Klamath, or are they all hatchery fish?
No, there is wild spawning in the Klamath.
A large degree, small degree, 5%?
I don't recall the ratio offhand. That was at one point presented by Neil Manchie during the early discussions. I unfortunately don't recall what that was. There is native spawning, and that's one of the things we're trying to protect by the regulations you have. We want to make sure that the natural spawners, that we have full utilization of all the appropriate habitat in the system. That's kind of the goals of the escapement.
In fact, that was fundamentally the crux of the matter when the irrigation error took place.
Among many, yes.
Commissioner Sutton?
I support this motion, but I was very moved by Zeke Grader's statement at the last commission meeting, reminder that just because we happen to have a good year in the Klamath doesn't mean the fundamental problems of the system have gone away, and we may well in the future be right back where we were last year in having to make some very difficult decisions. So anything that this commission can do to help resolve the thorny issues of the Klamath, I would be very much in favor of us considering.
That's well said. Any further comments? Zonke?
Yes, and I'll have to rely on commission staff for this. When I read the motion, it's not entirely clear. There are several options within many of the items in this rule package. It's not clear that the motion is accepting the department's recommendation. I would encourage, or I think it would be wise, to clarify that.
I'm happy to add that to my motion.
Thank you. That'll make it clear.
Is the seconder happy with that? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Item 14.
Item 14, request to publish notice of commission intent to amend section 29.85, title 14, CCR regarding crabs. Sonke?
Yes, commissioners, since this is kind of the first time you've been exposed to this, I will touch on it very quickly. What the issue is when legitimate Dungeness crab fishermen come in from the ocean through San Francisco into the bay to land, pull their boats out, etc. There's a quirk in the existing law that currently makes possession of those crabs in the bay illegal. And this rule change is to clarify that if you caught them legitimately out at sea, when you come into the bay, you may possess them to land them as long as you don't have gear in the water, etc. So this is just to clean up an unfortunate glitch we've had in this section.
Any questions or comments from the commission? Commissioner Hanna?
No, but I'm willing to make a motion.
Please do.
Excuse me,
Mr. Carlson, did you have a question or a comment?
No, I just say we have a staff suggested motion, but if Commissioner Hanna has that, that's fine.
I do.
Commissioner Hanna?
I'm reading it out of my...
Please read away.
Well, I didn't intend to read it all. I was just going to...
It's actually not very long.
Make a motion to approve the suggested motion.
Second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Item 15.
And for the record, we have had no speaker cards for these items, the last two items.
Of course.
Item 15, request to publish notice of commission intent to amend sections 251.7, 257, 300, and 600, Title 14, CCR, related to possession of game birds, resident small game defined, seasons and bag limits for upland game birds, and regulations for licensed game bird clubs. Please note that the discussion hearing for this is scheduled for June 8th, 2007, in Truckee.
Listen to Sonke.
I will be prompt here, but this item, again, is an item you are hearing for the first time. I wanted to draw attention. There are some significant, being a lot of you fellow bird hunters, we tend to be a rather... particular type about our bird rules and efforts. So there are some important things, and I'll highlight them very quickly. The current proposal you'll be proving to go to notice includes a possession, transportation, importation of game birds. Right now, you're not required to keep any identifying piece of the bird after you bag it. That's always given enforcement some problems in identification. This would require retaining a head or part of a wing so that positive identification as to what species of quail, for example, it will help. But as you know, that may cause some controversy.
It's exactly analogous to what we do with finfish.
Yes, exactly. Other item that's already gotten quite a bit of press is the Eurasian dove. The department's proposing adding Eurasian dove to the list of birds, doves you can hunt. However, we are recommending that it be part of the 10 daily bag limit. You may hear controversy that some want it as a bonus limit, and the department will explain its rationale as we get along, but you'll be hearing about this if you haven't already read. The other is, again, sage grouse. We come to you typically every year with sage grouse bag limits. We'll update those based on the latest information. Youth hunting season for turkeys. There was a proposal we were putting on the table to provide for youth spring turkey hunting during the extended archery season in the spring, so additional youth opportunity. The other is shooting hours and licensed game bird clubs. They differ from the non-shooting club upland bird hours, which has caused some confusion in the field. You hear, for example, pheasant shooting hour starts at 8 if you're hunting wild birds. But on a licensed pheasant club, you can start half hour before sunrise, and that causes some confusion in the field for enforcement and the public. So we're proposing them all be the same, so everyone starts hunting at the same time. And then the other were minor editorial changes to clean up some errors in the regulations.
Any questions from the commission? Comments? Do I hear a motion?
I move that staff be directed to publish notice for this item.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right.
Aye.
Moving right along, consent calendar.
I move the consent calendar.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Any comments or questions?
For
those who are physically challenged and can't flip the page. You're fine?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, John, you might point out which items the consent calendar includes.
Yeah, suggested motion,
for everyone.
Suggested motion from staff is
17
that
through 22.
The Fish and Game Commission hereby approves 17 through 22 on the consent calendar.
And that has been moved. We have a second, right?
Yes.
Right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. And we are now at item 23, announcement of future meetings.
Announcement of future meetings. Our next meeting is June 7th and 8th in Truckee, followed by July 12th and 13th in Bridgeport, followed by August 9th and 10th in Santa Barbara. Let me remind folks, for the rest of the calendar year, our meetings are up on our website with dates and locations.
Any further items? Do I have a motion? I have a motion for adjournment from Commissioner Kellogg. Do I have a second? All those in favor? Aye. Stand adjourned.